Hello, young minds. It's me, Dr. Smith. Today I am going to talk to you about the work of the great Jean-Jacques Rousseau, a man who I always think of as part of the French Enlightenment. He regarded himself as a Genevan, was born and raised there, even though he ran away in 1725. Apparently, because he was locked outside of the walls, there's got to be something else there. And given his history with ladies, I wonder how much of that has evolved. But that's for a different class, I reckon, a history class to get into. Rousseau, we're going to talk about several of his works and the key concepts that came from them. Before we do, I just want to give you, I want to fill you in on what resources you might want to turn to if you're looking for extra, since we're not in class. And If you're interested in one of these, you can't just come up to me afterwards. One is I used George H. Sabine and Thomas L. Thorson's History of Political Theory. It's an older book, but it's one that I relied on in graduate school, and I really love it. I also used just the Penguin translation of The Social Contract. By Maurice Cranston. Nothing fancy, but it's literally, let's see, what year? I got this, the edition I have, I bought in around 2000. Let's see, that's 2000. Who cares? But it's an older version. And then, of course, I also have the Donald A. Kress edition of the basic political writings of Jean-Jacques Rousseau, which includes the Discourse on the Sciences and Arts, Discourse on the Origin of Inequality, the Discourse on Political Economy, and on the Social Contract, all of which are, if you have the chance, they're all worth reading in their complete form. I also checked out the Internet of Encyclopedia or the Internet Encyclopedia of Philosophy, which is always a great source. They have an article on Rousseau by James J. Delaney and from Niagara University. And I checked out, as I usually do in prepping anything, the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, also online. Another really just great source. And their article on Rousseau, written by a guy named Christopher Bertram. So there's obviously untold amounts of ink spilled on Rousseau. If you're looking to learn more about Rousseau, you're not going to have any problem finding that good stuff. So that's pretty much it. Builds character, puts hair on your chest, and we'll move on from there. And we'll start talking about the substance of Rousseau in particular. So, just to give you a basic timeline, because I always think that's useful. Again, he was born in 1710 in the Republic of Geneva. He fled Geneva for Savoy in 1725. He was 15. In 1737, he moved to Lyon, where he became a tutor. And then a few years after that, about 5 years after that, 1742, he moved to Paris. He actually served for a time. I didn't actually write that down on my main list. Let me double check my other notes. From 1743 to 1744, he actually served as the secretary of the French ambassador to Venice. So he did spend some time in Venice, in Italy, and I know he actually gained quite a love for Italian music from that, even though Rousseau's not really my expertise. I've just read about that in the past. He also, in 1749, we see he begins his career in terms of really important political philosophy. And that is with the publication of the Discourse on the Sciences and Arts. In 1755, he's going to publish the Discourse on the Origins of Inequality, the second discourse. Around the same time, he's going to publish the most important article he'll contribute to the encyclopedia, the kind of famous French attempt to, or French Enlightenment attempt to gather all the knowledge of the world, or as reasonably close as anyone could, by Diderot and I can't remember the other gentleman's name who kind of like orchestrated that. It doesn't really matter, but he wrote a discourse on political economy for that, which introduces a lot of the concepts that he's going to then further flush out in the book he's most famous for in the United States. And it's very important, The Social Contract. He writes a lot of other books, one of which, Emile, is, it's kind of interesting because it's about the Emile, is that the right way to put it? I don't know. The fundamental concepts of natural education, which I think a lot of those we find in other liberal thinkers, but basically this idea that we need to be thinking about education and children in a way that is more natural, that we see really beginning to penetrate liberal thought with guys like Locke and the British Enlightenment in the 17th century. But not to dwell on that too long, it's also worth noting before we dive in that in many ways, some people regard Rousseau as the father of what we might call the counter-Enlightenment. I prefer really, and maybe this comes from my background in the arts, to think of Rousseau as the father of what we call Romanticism. Romanticism is, in essence, the that movement which emerges in the middle of, basically in the late 1700s, early 1800s, kind of the dead center of what we think of as the modern epoch or the modern era. And Romanticism is a reaction to modernization and a reaction to modernity, a reaction to mechanistic thinking, to rationalism, to scientism, to like any attempt to rationally organize the world, rationally organize labor, rationally organize everything, which is a hallmark of a lot of Renaissance and Enlightenment thought and continues to be obviously very important in the modern world today. Romanticism is obviously a reaction about that. It's basically predicated on the idea that we've lost something very, very important by becoming post-romantic, not post-romantic, St. Andrew, by becoming rationalist, by giving up a lot of what was really beautiful and brilliant about the pre-modern world, and particularly, I think, the medieval world. The interest in emotion, in love, in death, in the sacred, the sense that we have a kind of organic connection to the world and to one another that is lost, in a sense, as we move into the scientific, rationalist, individualist era. And a number of different thinkers, many artists, many philosophers, many other scholars, wonderful, wonderful authors, of course, are going to have this similar reaction. They're going to be part of this movement against the rationalistic vision of the world being utterly dominant, and its vision of humans as ultimately machines, like we're creatures who are reacting deterministically to the world based on cold hard egoism, that is to say, self-interest, and what we're going to see is that's just not something that that the romantics favor or accept. So this leads us to the first discourse. The first discourse, and the first two discourses, it should say, are both these essays that Rousseau submits to the Academy of Dijon, prompted. They're basically part of a contest, and the contest is there is a prompt question, and then the authors are supposed to write a response. And Rousseau wins the first of these contest, his first discourse. He loses the second. He actually disobeys a lot of the rules. It's something like four times as long as it's supposed to be, and just really ignores the rules of the contest. And this causes him, not unexpectedly, to just not lose, even though the second discourse, honestly, today in the modern world, is probably going to come to be the more important of the publications of inspired by the Academy of Dijon. So the first discourse, what do we got here? Well, the prompt in question is this. Has the restoration of sciences and arts tended to purify morals? Rousseau, as a romantic or a proto-romantic or whatever you want to think of him as, is going to have a very simple answer to that. And he's going to say, no, it doesn't. It doesn't. And his simple answer is easy to comprehend. He says, first off, the expression of modern science and the incredible improvement and skill and specialization in modern arts and craftsmanship has led to a substantial increase in luxury and leisure, what we might think of as all the things that prevent us from having simple, virtuous lives. They make us immoderate. They make us licentious. And there's a pretty direct correlation there, I think. It's pretty easy to understand what Rousseau's saying, that the more stuff we have, the more specialization we have, the more we dwell on our stuff and our experiences and our physical interaction with pleasure, the less we are prone to think about high-minded things. And there's certainly, it's pretty difficult to just outright reject that protest. He also says that, and this is where I think he's a little kooky, but who am I to judge? He says, the arts and sciences, in essence, are born of our vices. We produce these things out of an interest in alleviating our own labor, in alleviating our own sense that we want to increase our own wealth, we want to increase our own fame, we want to increase our own sense of importance, so that we have vanity in there. If we include things like food, you know, it's gluttony. It's all these different, you know, the seven deadly sins. Ultimately, it is these vices that Rousseau believes lead us to become obsessed with improving our scientific knowledge and improving the arts. It actually makes me think of a little bit. If you've read the series of novels, the Dune series of novels, this isn't so much a theme in the first one, but in the later novels, there's this kind of intergalactic civilization that has emerged in which people live very simple lives unless they are elites in that civilization. The vast majority of people are farmers and simple craftsmen and so forth. And they're living lives that are, in essence, maybe not merely existential, right? They're not just simply keeping themselves alive, but they're not producing so much surplus that they have the luxury of being layabouts or of idling in their pursuits for pleasure. They have to work, and this keeps them. The idea is, at least, it keeps them more politically stable, more socially stable, and in the long run, happier and more virtuous. Of course, this has got to be run by a despot in that series of novels. And one is inclined to think, if one is seeing this from a country that is really interested in the arts and sciences, like, say, the modern United States, that there is some kind of hint of this sort of elitism, that this is a vision of the world in which the majority of the people will be limited in how they get to choose pleasure, how they get to choose to live. Anyways, Rousseau's final argument is going to be basically it emphasizes talent over what we might think of as the political virtues. Now, if you remember back in class, we talked about Machiavelli, we talked about Virtù quite a bit. And virtu is basically all the different kinds of concepts, all the different attributes, if you will, that a human being can culture in themselves that make them better at politics, better at serving their community, better at guaranteeing their survival and the survival of their state, and at maintaining an ethical and high quality and durable life. And what Rousseau argues is that the arts and sciences, on the contrary to kind of Machiavelli, they instead of accentuating our virtues and perhaps even giving us more virtues to hang our hat on, the arts and sciences have tended to undermine our virtue and have tended to result in a hollowing out of virtue. So things like courage, generosity, moderation, temperance, all of those sorts of things have become less important with the emergence of modernity. And I always get the sense of this, this is going to remind me of, this is obviously going to be very important when we get to people. If you study things like Marxian thought, it's going to be important when you study things like fascist thought. But it's also quite interesting because it is a kind of like, it is romantic. It is this sense that the Middle Ages were, you know, life was maybe brutal and short and violent, comparative to the modern world, which is, of course, when people have lived, they live for a very long time on average in developed nations. They live relatively peacefully. They have access to enormous amounts of technology and information. But is the quality of life that good? Is it comparable to the Middle Ages and to this period in which there was this kind of perceived role of nobility and honor and so forth? And I just won't, I don't know. I just don't buy Rousseau and the Romantics' argument that there is some sort of inherent superiority in a system that was more noble or a system that was hinges on duty. Now, possibly it should be said, this also hinges on one of those kinds of paradoxes, right, that we're going to see over and over. There's a tension in Rousseau's, or a lot of tensions in Rousseau's work. He doesn't always fill out his ideas. He doesn't always connect the dots in a way that makes them fully consistent. So Rousseau, we're going to see, is an ardent believer in things like human equality and in a democratic state. But we're also going to see that concept of democracy and equality is one which is deeply attenuated and oftentimes kind of arbitrarily absolute. So it is strange. It doesn't fit well into our categorization of, is Rousseau a liberal in the sense of, say, Locke, or is Rousseau a conservative, or even a kind of fundamentalist of a maybe a secular type. That tension is very real. Does he support the virtues of what we might think of as almost knightliness, or does he support what we think of as democratic virtues? And the truth is probably somewhere in between. I think it's both. I think that he wants his cake and to eat it too, and it's frustrating that he's trying to devise a way to achieve a state and to achieve a political economy throughout his works that accomplishes both of those. But we'll keep moving forward rather than dwell on that too much at this moment. That leads us to the second discourse, the discourse on the origins of inequality. And the Academy of Dijon had another prompting question, of course. What is the origin of inequality among men? And is it authorized by natural law? It's an interesting question. It's a question that you could argue is maybe one of the most foundational questions in all of modern political thought. I think it's really fascinating. And Rousseau's response to this is to avoid overly emphasizing the question as it's asked. Rousseau doesn't really buy into the classical traditional understanding of what is natural. He's going to be kind of like, he's going to build on the Hobbesian groundwork. And actually, there's a fair amount of, I think it's very fair to say that Rousseau does build on Hobbes in a lot of different ways. But maybe the most key one is he's going to argue that we need to be very careful about what we claim is natural versus what we claim is artificial. And so the state of nature for Rousseau, like Hobbes, is going to be this condition of anarchy in which we see human beings without artifice, without technologies. And so we're starting from scratch. Now, again, like Hobbes, there's reason to believe Rousseau never actually thought that this state of nature was real, but that it might be merely a heuristic device to help us conceptualize this condition of humans without the state, the condition of anarchy. But whether it did or didn't exist, he's still going to treat it as a starting point. So let's dive into it. First off, he says that the state of nature, this condition of anarchy, is one where humans are uncorrupted, where we are simple, where we are individualistic. And he contrasts this simplicity with Hobbes in some important ways. Let's actually look at it compared to Hobbes and Locke, actually, because I think that makes sense given our previous discussions. So, pardon me, guys. So for Hobbes, when we look at the state of nature, it's one in which human beings are essentially individualist and they're self-interested and they're rational and they're equal, right? And that mix leads them to be egoistic. It leads them to be distrustful. It leads them into a condition of war of all against all. And there is a sense of relatively instantaneous, rational attempts to exploit the world and its resources in Hobbesian thought. With Locke, we see a world that he posits we're living in anarchy, but we're already in society. Humans are naturally social. So it's not completely atomistic. It's not completely egoistic. It is self-interested, but it's a self-interest, as you remember, that's moderated by things like a natural understanding, a natural reasonable understanding of what is right and wrong as derived from the world. And essential, of course, that is his concept of life, liberty, health, and property. So when we contrast both of those to Rousseau, Rousseau is saying, in essence, if we imagine human beings in this perfect state, this original state, we are simple, right? So we're individualist. We don't have technologies. We don't even necessarily have language, which I find a fascinating kind of attempt to assume, you know, what is the human being? We are egoistic in the sense that we're trying to stay alive, but we are not just self-interested. Our self-interested is in balance with the specific emotion he talks about. I actually got the quote here: innate repugnance to see his fellow suffer. Now, what does that sound like? How would we say that more simply? Pity, right? We have empathy and sympathy for our fellow human being. So on the one hand, yes, we do want to stay alive. We do want to improve our quality of life. And on the other hand, we do feel empathy, pity, sympathy for other human beings. Now, what's critical here is for Rousseau, notice he's not emphasizing the rational aspect of humanity as a starting point. Rather, it's the emotional characteristic of humanity that's his starting point. We are, first off, these kind of inherent, innate, instinctive, emotional beings. Then it is only later that questions of things like really questions of rationality emerge. Now, that doesn't mean that we're irrational, right? It means that rationality is really reactive in human beings. As we find ourselves in different circumstances, our inherent capacity for rationality pokes its head out of the sand and begins to allow us to resolve solutions. And so we begin to develop technologies, whether we're talking about language, whether we're talking about agriculture, whether we're talking about metallurgy, what have you. We develop these concepts in reaction to particular circumstances we find ourselves in. So it should be said, a lot of authors will call this condition of simplicity the term that's become very, very common, and it's a pretty grotesque term, and I don't really like it, but it's also so common in the literature, I feel obliged to bring it up, is the term is noble savage, or the state of noble savagery. And it's, one is inclined to think that this is the result of people who are misinterpreting how people who live in societies before the emergence of written law-based civilization has been either developed by them or imposed upon them. So that is to say, people who live in tribal and other types of political arrangements that are not what we would traditionally call a state. And this belief that they are simple, that they are more noble. I'm always reminded, actually, of there was a commercial that was very, very famous, and you've probably even seen it online or not or at some point. There's a Native American gentleman, and he's standing by the road, and I believe he's not actually Native American. I think it's like a white guy playing him, and it's an example of racial masquerading. But there's a gentleman, and he's standing by the road, and a car passes, and they throw some trash out, and it hits the Native American gentleman's foot. And as the camera pans up, you see tears falling from the eyes of the gentleman's face. And what this is it's supposed to evoke a sense of we are in tune with nature when we are at our technological simplicity. What Native Americans were, is this commercial is kind of implying, and the whole tradition of noble savagery implies, is a group of human beings like other tribal peoples who are more in sync with nature, who are more in sync with that emotive, natural, normal condition of the world. All those things that the Romantics, right, are really digging, than are people who live in like modern states and organized political systems. And this is, of course, problematic in a host of ways, not the least of which is you're not really engaging in an honest kind of anthropology of peoples if you're trying to like broadly stroke and say, oh, this whole category of human beings is absolutely good and this other group is bad and their morals are superior and their morals are inferior. What we're doing is we're still engaging in reductivism, and that's bad form. And I think that there's some of that in Rousseau. I think there's a lot more of that in the interpretation, the more I've read, the interpretation of Rousseau by people. Anyways, so things are pretty good in the state of nature until you have the invention of this concept called inequality. Now, inequality is kind of an accident. It emerges out of the series of phases of human life, of human society and economy. First off, we start by beginning to cooperate. Rousseau seemed to think this is for pretty discrete things, like to hunt, to gather, to make and raise babies and so forth, as opposed to, say, a Lockean vision of the world, which I think, frankly, in this regard is more likely, which is that humans are intrinsically social creatures. And human beings in this earlier state, eventually these social units begin to become more and more permanent. We begin to, in other words, recognize that society alleviates certain needs. We begin to be rational. And there are side effects of this the invention of society, this early form of society, things like pride, things like love, things like preference and partialism and partiality and so forth. And it begins a kind of a rolling process of rationalism. Once you start to have preference, you start to have competition between groups, and you also have competition for resources. And so human beings do what human beings do, argues Rousseau. I think here he's on firmer ground. We start to invent other things. So obviously he says we invent language, but more importantly, we invent those things like agriculture and metallurgy and all these more complex tools. And all this, of course, leads to the invention of property, a sense of ownership. And ownership, property, is really critically different here from Locke's concept. Remember, Locke argues that there are the four kind of sacred, essential, and inalienable rights: life, liberty, health, property. These are things that are intrinsic. Any reasonable person can see that they are intrinsic in our lives. On the other hand, with Rousseau, we're seeing something quite different. Rousseau says that property is merely an object that we construct. It's something that we invent in order to alleviate needs. So there's a rational purpose for it. We invent it. And there are unintended or unanticipated consequences of property. Property leads us to begin to specialize. Some of us specialize in certain kinds of economic activities. Others of us specialize in different economic activities. And this is really critical, because what it does is it begins to lead to the emergence of inequality. Inequality both within society, because we start to get social classes, and inequality between different pre-state groups. In other words, different, say, tribal units or families begin to have unequal attributes, unequal characteristics. Their capabilities are different. And this leads to competition, which is essentially distrustful. It is, as our concept, a good way to think of it is that as our understanding of the world increases, as we become less simple and more complex in our comprehension of the world, we become more egoistic instinctively, and we become more instinctively self-interested and more distrustful. So the net effect of the emergence of society and the emergence of the feelings that accompany society and the emergence of property and all the other ways of generating and manipulating property into more advanced and complex forms lead us to a state which is essentially identical to Hobbes's state of nature. One in which we are in a condition of fairly violent conflict. And this is why we have to invent the state. We invent the state in an attempt to escape from the collapse of our Edenic, simple state of nature. So we have this very natural life. In our attempt to improve it, we actually wreck it. And in wrecking it, we then create the state in an attempt to escape the wreckage and to return at least in part to that condition of the good life. And what Rousseau is basically going to tell us is we fail. We screw up. The state doesn't, in fact, actually preserve or return us to a state of nature. But in fact, what it does is it reinforces existing inequalities and makes them more stable. So it ends the war of all against all, to use the Hobbesian phrase, but it does it in a way which guarantees that those who are on top at the beginning stay on top, and those who are on the bottom at the beginning remain peons. And it establishes the state as a permanent kind of kleptocracy, right? It's a pretty brilliant model. And it's obviously going to inspire a lot of different thinkers, especially Marxian thinkers. But that leads us into the third discourse, the discourse on political economy, which again was originally written as an article for the encyclopedia. This discourse introduces an idea that basically we call the general will, or Rousseau calls the general will. I shouldn't take any credit for that at all. And to understand the general will, we should contrast it with the concept of particular will. So general will is a holist concept versus particular will, which is an atomistic concept. So think of it like this. I'm an individual. My interest, my will, my desire, those are all things that are egoistic. It's about serving me. What Rousseau will argue in the discourse on political economy is that there are society has a parallel to this, a general will. That is a general concept, a general set of interests, and a general set of desires for what the state should do. And that these are analogous to the particular will of the individual. And not only that, they supersede it. That the social will is more just than the particular will of the individual, and therefore is more important to be abided by. This is a very kind of intriguing concept because it does get at the heart of what's going to become like this concept we're going to talk about a lot called faction. We've talked about it a little bit, right? But ultimately, we have this dilemma, which is how do we design a political system that both preserves the rights and interests of individuals on the one hand and serves to protect the rights and interests and needs of society on the other hand? Rousseau is absolutely going to create a tension. I genuinely believe when you read Rousseau, he's going to believe that he's creating a system that resolves this tension in a way that is practical. And I think he's wrong myself. See, what Rousseau is going to argue is that, well, we'll get into this more with the social contract. But what he's going to argue is that the ideal state is going to be, on the one hand, completely, its behavior will be completely dependent upon the general will of the body politic. We'll define that term in a second. On the other hand, in obeying the general will, it will be fulfilling every individual's particular will. Now, if you're like me and you believe that there are always intrinsically a large number of individual and collective, what we might think of as minority factions in any given society, and then what we see is that Rousseau is basically kind of sweeping those under the rug. He's going to argue this. We can see part of this sweeping when he defines in the Discourse on Political Economy what the ethical state is. Now, remember, he's going to say, he tells us in the Discourse on Inequality, the Origins of Inequality, that most states are licentious, kleptocratic, that there aren't, if there are, they are rare. There are rarely any just states, and if there are just states, they're few and far between. Rousseau is going to basically say, if we want to be able to recognize an ethical state, if and when we ever come across one, there are three big standards we have to abide by. So the first standard is the state has to obey the general will. So the state has to fulfill the desire of the collective will of the people. Now, he's really ambiguous about what this means. Does this mean the majority will, or does it mean something more mystical? Now, let me actually explain that for a second. If you don't know what the concept of mysticism is, it's worth kind of thinking about. To be mysticism, the way we normally use it, especially in like theology, is this idea that we as individuals or as groups of individuals are attempting to form a direct communion with the divine, with God or some other divine, God, the gods, or some other divine force. So mysticism is literally like an attempt to directly connect to the divine. When we look at the general will as our friend Rousseau is developing it, it has kind of the odor of mysticism. But here, instead of Rousseau arguing, pardon me, I apologize, guys. Instead of Rousseau arguing that the mystical connection we should be aiming at is one with a deity or deities or some other divine force, in fact, the mysticism that matters is with everyone else in our society, in our body politic, and that the general will, therefore, is an artificial will. So just like for Hobbes, the Leviathan is a body politic that is artificial. It is an artificial human being. But for Hobbes, the sovereign is whoever we designate the sovereign. For Rousseau, the body politic is this artificial being, and the artificial being is itself the sovereign. It is the body politic is collectively the sovereign, as opposed to it has a designated partner who is the sovereign. We'll talk about that in a second. And so the general will is kind of the soul, if you will, of society, of the state, of the body politic. He also argues that the ethical state will ensure that the particular wills of individuals will accord with the general will. In other words, it's going to make sure that all of us agree to obey the general will, that it's what we should do. Now, this is something that if you're kind of a Lockean individualist or in any of the kind of like English language tradition of liberalism, it makes you probably a little wiggly. The reason for this is that the general will is the argument that we should bring everyone into accord with the general will is to a degree problematic. It infers that we are going to take normal human beings, take their vision of the world, and we're going to bring them into accord with whatever the proper general will is, which has this air of superiority, aristocracy, whatever you want to call it. It's a little problematic. It's also going to be an idea that's going to be leapt upon by other thinkers, including fascist thinkers. So, and then finally, we have this final big measure of an ethical state, which is the public's needs are satisfied, which is the most uncontroversial of it. So he's making sure to distinguish between the general will and the general interest, which is critical for him. So what we want versus what we absolutely have to have, which is, again, problematic if we're going to think in terms of individualism, majoritarianism, etc. For this to work, he also says everyone has to meet two preconditions, right? There are preliminary conditions. One is we have to realize that we're all equal, and the other is we have to respect and obey the law, both of which, needless to say, are easier said than done. And then finally, this leads us to the work he's most famous for, the social contract, right? The social contract basically seeks to describe how we could create a legitimate state. Now, it should be noted, I think it's worth saying here, is that Rousseau is kind of obsessed with city-states. He will spend a lot of his life constantly kind of reiterating he is Genevan, he is from this city-state, even though he ran away, he got in trouble there, he lost his citizenship for a while. He also is going to be particularly fascinated with states like Sparta, even as he kind of criticizes other city-states like Athens for their licentiousness. But he prefers the city-state, and he seems to prefer this concept of direct democracy, with the idea that direct democracy is this kind of unattenuated way that the general will can be expressed. Obviously, that's not feasible in a large political system. So Rousseau would probably argue that no modern state that I can think of meets his standard for being a legitimate and ethical polity. But it was a very famous quote, and of course, the social contract that I've just got to say, because if you talk about the social contract and you don't read it, then that's an enormous faux pas. Man is born free, and everywhere he is in chains, is the quote. And basically, the idea is that we are naturally free, and we are supposed to be in a condition of freedom under the kind of ideal state that he argues, or in the kind of simple condition that was emotional rather than rationalistic, that anarchy of the state of nature. And instead, we find ourselves trapped in socio-political inequality, which is exploitative. And this is, by the way, bad for the wealthy and the powerful, just like it is for the poor. Though one has to assume, if you've got to choose, most of us are going to choose to be powerful and wealthy. The poor, of course, are being trod upon and exploited. The wealthy are just living less than good lives. They're living less than ideal lives. They're unethical lives. They're meaningless lives that don't make them happy. And there we go on that. I won't dive into that too much. So this brings us to a big question. He's told us that the general will is the measure, basically, of a good state, of a state like that is functioning well, and that the general will is an expression of the body politic. So what the hell does that mean? Where does the body politic come from? All right. I have always used this argument. One of the phrases that we often see thrown around is that we have a mutual alienation of powers. A different way to put that is, imagine what distinguishes us in anarchy from what distinguishes us from one another in a state. In anarchy, I have, as Hobbes and Locke would both argue, the freedom to use force to resolve conflict in my own interest. Now, Locke attenuates that by saying that freedom to use force has to be ethical. We have to do it in a way that's ethical. Hobbes is more, you know, mama hoo-hoo on that. Not mama hoo, he just doesn't care or doesn't buy that, maybe a better way to put it. Rousseau is going to argue, on the other hand, that we do, ultimately, it's probably somewhat closer to Hobbes, at least in practice, right? Because even though we may start out simple, once we reach the stage where we have to invent the state, we've entered into a condition of what is effectively a war of all against all. And that means that we are settling disputes in our own interest with our own force. And what we do, the way we create the body politic, is we give up, we alienate that power to use force. And the way we do this, the way I've always loved describing it, is imagine three people sitting around, and each of them has two apples. And someone comes up behind them and says, all right, now give up your apples to one another. And everyone gives up their apples to everyone else. At the end of the exchange, everybody still has two apples. But the effect is that we have the formation of mutual exchange. We retain our essential powers, but we have created a contractual association that's basically it, an association which is effectively contractual, though not contractual in any traditional sense of the word, the way that like Hobbes or Locke would use it. Notice there is no sovereign that is alienated. There is no sovereign that is engaging in this deal with everyone who is not a sovereign. The sovereign becomes the body politic because the individuals create the body politic, which renders them collectively a sovereign, an absolute sovereign. So where then does the state come from? Well, the body politic is the people. The state then is basically created by the people. It is an instrument of the general will, which means the state is not a signatory. It has no right to exist in any particular form. It exists in the form that it does because of the will of the people who have constituted the state through the formation of the body politic. And if at any point the body politic decides it wants a different type of state or a different set of people in charge of the state, then by God, they have the right to create that different type of state. This is gigantically important because what it does is it argues that there is kind of an intrinsic right to revolution in every political system without having the state have to screw up. For Hobbes, there's no right to revolution. For Locke, revolution is only legitimate when we have a political circumstance that necessitates it. For Rousseau, revolution is appropriate, basically, whenever the people damn well want it. Now, this revolution doesn't have to be violent revolution necessarily. And so when we look at modern written constitutions, what we see is that, yes, some of them are just overthrown for even in democratic states or simply replaced with new constitutional documents. Others, like the American Constitution, have put this idea into effect in a very simple way, which is they have a system of amendments. Other philosophers have argued for even more dramatic things. So you have kind of inspired by this Rousseauian idea, Jefferson's idea that once a generation we should have a kind of a constitutional convention in which we all sit down and we decide, do we want to keep the constitution we have or do we want a new constitution? And if we want a new constitution, how are we going to revise it? Basically, to prevent older generations' general will from imposing themselves on contemporary generations. Obviously, Jefferson is going to lose that fight. We don't do that. And that's probably for the best because of, you know, that could lead to some real drama. So basically what this means is that the state, its purposes, again, if we go back to the discourse on political economy and we look at other parts of the social contract, the state is supposed to obey the general will and fulfill the general interest. That's really what it's for. The conundrum with this is that Rousseau doesn't really give us a clear way of defending individual interests, individual rights, the rights of minorities, the right of dissenters. In fact, he seems to believe that there just automatically will be either a defense of those or there simply will be no dissent in this kind of hyper-idealized polity. It's a wonderful example of the problem that we have when we're trying to design democracies. Democracies are majoritarian or pluralistic. I don't know if that's a word. Pluralistic. No, that's not right. Democracies are, in their perfect form, they're going to have everyone agree unanimously on everything. Like, that would be the ideal. But in practice, they function based on majorities or on pluralities. They are the product of compromise after compromise. And if a majority or a majoritarian system does a poor job of looking out for the interests of minorities, as one that was based on the simplest interpretation of Rousseau would do, well, then if you don't want to be in the minority because you're going to have people try and tell you you're simply wrong because you disagree with the general will, or you're going to be told that, you know, the general will is actually looking out for you even if you disagree. All sorts of problems there. Well, guys, that is the super fast introduction to Rousseau. As fast as I could make it, there's a lot in there. We could go on and on. I mean, heck, you could spend a lifetime really talking about Rousseau. If you have any questions, if you have anything you want to talk about further, please call me, email me, write me, and let me know if you have any problems getting a hold of this, though. Maybe, I guess, if you were, you wouldn't be able to hear it. Anyways, I will talk to you later, and I hope you have a wonderful day. And again, stay safe, stay well, and take care of yourself, guys. And I will talk to you soon. Dr. Smith is out.